Doors are closing. I will get started. Okay, so I am Damien Edwards. If you haven't been to one of my sessions yet, I'm a senior program manager on the ASP.NET team. And today I am here to talk to you about doing real-time programming on ASP.NET. So the idea of my clients, rather than just requesting pages and then them getting back a bunch of HTML and doing some stuff and then making another request for another page, having a persistent real-time connection between the browser and the server. You may have heard of WebSockets, part of the umbrella HTML5 term. We are going to see WebSockets in this talk, but predominantly, or completely, we're going to be talking about a technology called SignalR, which is the little name in parentheses there. SignalR is a, I'm sick of those, let's just do some coding. I don't like slides. All right, so I'm going to fire up Visual Studio. 2012, I'm running Windows 8. RC on here. Let's create a new empty web application. And then with the magic and power of NuGet, I'm going to bring in a completely working demo because that's how I roll. Signaler.sample. Here it is, signaler.sample. You can follow along on your notebooks if you want to. I'm installing from a local copy of NuGet, so it might be a little bit slower. Okay, so I'm going to come in here, stockticker.html, and I'm going to control F5 to run that up. And after a couple of seconds of initial compilation, we should see I get a page with a fancy grid. Well, not so fancy. There it is. I'm going to pin that one over there. And we'll grab another browser and we'll pin that one over there. And then over here, I'm going to click Open Market. And then we'll start to see updates coming through and showing in the browser. So fully functional, working signaler sample available on NuGet. In this case, we've got a stock ticker. It's a fake stock ticker. They're not the real stock prices. If they were, I'd be pretty upset because I have a lot of Microsoft stock, and it was worth more than that last time I checked. And we've got a little slidey thing across the bottom, too. But you can see that when we click things, they synchronize across both browsers. So I can come over to the left and click Open Market, and the buttons synchronize their sort of operation on the right-hand side. But let's build something from scratch. It's all good looking at something that was built previously, but let's just build a complete demonstration from scratch. So I'm going to create a new folder. I'm going to call it MoveShape. And I'm going to start out on the server side. So let's create a new class. I'm going to call that MoveShape Hub, not Hug. Well, that would be kind of nice. Let's call that MoveShape Hub, derived from SignalR's Hub class. So this is a SignalR intrinsic called Hub. And a hub is a thing that clients connect to and talk to each other through. Okay? And the server can also use a hub to broadcast out to connected clients, the ones that are connected to this hub. I'm going to add a public method to this hub called MoveShape, and it's going to take an x-coordinate and a y-coordinate. And then inside here, I'm going to tell all the clients that are currently connected that a shape just got moved. So I'm going to say clients.shapeMoved. I'm going to pass in the current connection ID and the x and y-coordinates that were passed in. Now, clients, if we look very, very closely, is a dynamic property. And so what I'm actually saying is that the client's property represents all the people currently connected to this hub. And what I want to do is go ahead and call the shape moved property on some client-side representation in some client code. So the shape moved doesn't exist in the server world. That's why this is dynamic. It's not a real method. When I compile it, it compiles, but the method doesn't exist. And I'm going to pass in some parameters to it, and all that magic is going to happen at runtime for me. So let's do our client-side coding. Let's add a JavaScript file, and we'll call that moveShape.js. Let's drag in a couple of references so we get some nice jQuery, IntelliSense, and whatnot. At this point, I know I need another library, so I'm going to jump out to NuGet again, install jQuery UI, because I want part of jQuery UI for this demo. And we'll drag that in as well. Then I'm just going to do some basic jQuery type stuff, add a body load handler. And then inside here, I'm going to say var hub is equal to $.connection.moveShape. So $.connection, connection was added by this file here. Connection is an extension to jQuery that SignalR added. So the SignalR jQuery, SignalR JavaScript library is itself a jQuery plugin. So just like you have $.ajax, we have $.connection. And moveShape is the name of this hub. So let's before I forget to do that, give this hub a name, because I don't want it to be called MoveShape Hub on the client. I just want it to be called MoveShape. So there we go. So MoveShape, like so. Then I'm going to grab a variable which is going to contain a DOM element that I'll create in just a moment. Next thing I'm going to do is add that client-side method to this hub. So I'm going to extend this hub. This is the jQuery extend method that lets you take one JavaScript object and dynamically just add more stuff to it. So I'm going to say extend hub with whatever is on this object literal. And on this object literal, I have to add a method called shapeMoved, because that's the method I'm going to call from the server. And that is going to take, if you remember, a connection ID, an X, and a Y. And what do I want shapeMoved to do? Well, first thing I'm going to do is check to make sure that this didn't come from myself. So I'm going to say if connection ID is not equal to $.connection.hub.id. So this, if this move invocation did not come from myself, it came from a different connection, a connection with a different ID, then go ahead and on shape update its position on the screen. I can just do that using jQuery again. So left is going to be that, and Y is going to be the top. So that's cool. Good. So the last thing I need to do now is start the connection with the server and then wire up the client-side behavior that's going to let this demo work. And so let's go ahead and start the connection. That's $.connection.hub.start. And then when that's done, so this is a jQuery deferred. This was introduced in jQuery, 1.5, I think it was. Just like $.ajax returns a promise that you can then chain with .done, and the jQuery animations do the same thing, we do the same thing. So hub.start is asynchronous. It's going to start a connection, and then when it's finished starting, I want to run this Lambda here. When it's done, I'm going to go ahead and wire up some more behavior to this shape. So I'm going to make it draggable, and then I want to say when the drag event takes place, this is standard jQuery UI, I'm going to go ahead and call the server and let the server know that the shape moved on the screen because the user moved it. So I'm going to say hub.moveShape, because if we go back to my server side, I added a method called moveShape on the hub that's public, so that can be called. And I have to pass in the current X and Y, so that's this.offsetLeft. This is just standard DOM now, just standard web programming, this.offsetTop, or 0 if that hasn't been set. And that's my JavaScript done. So let's go and add HTML now. index.html. Let's drag in the world. So I need jQuery, jQuery UI, Signaler, and MoveShape. Let's drag those into here and drop them in as references. And then I need one extra reference, which is kind of a magic reference in Signaler world, which we'll look at in just a little moment in more detail. So this is Signaler/hubs. Then I'm going to add that shape that we know that my JavaScript is talking to. So that's going to be a div with an ID of shape. And then finally, to make sure that my shape can be seen, I'm going to add some styling. So we're going to say shape is going to have a width of, say, 100 pixels. And a height of 100 pixels, so it's a square, and a background color of that nice blue over there. Let's try that again. I like my color picker. Where is it? There it is. Oop, wrong keystroke. Down first and then across. There we go, that one. And let's close our rule. Okay, that looks pretty good. Let's build that, make sure it compiles. So far, so good. Let's run it. One over here. Let's bring up another browser while that's waiting, doing the first compile. There it is. One over here, and I picked the shape up, and I've made a mistake. So let's have a look at my errors. Oops, not that one. Come across. I got a 500 cannot call method start of undefined, so that means I have messed up one of my references. So let's have a quick look. jQuery, blah, 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 UI, Signaler, Signaler.hub. Move shape, what have I done wrong? I'm hearing 400 different things. Thank you. It was always something silly like a reference. And that, you know what? That's the exact same mistake I made when I practiced this 35 minutes ago. Don't you love that? So F5, bring that across here. Bring that one over there. There it is. Get rid of this. And now when I pick this up and move it, it moves in both browsers, no matter which side I do it in. So it helps to get your JavaScript references right. So that was pretty easy, despite the little stumble there at the end. So let's have a look a little bit more detail about what really happened there. So let's go back to one of these browsers. Let's maximize it and bring up the network tools. I'm going to have a closer look at what's going on here. Let's hit F5. A bunch of network requests are being made, which are kind of cool. Here's that magic hubs network request that I got wrong. Now, that's obviously not a JavaScript file. It's just going to /signal/hubs. Now, what is that? Well, if I drill into that, what this is magic. This is where the good stuff happens. So this is JavaScript that got built on the fly on the server based on my C#, based on that hub class that I created, that move shape hub. And so there's a whole bunch of stuff at the top which is kind of always the same, but if we scroll down, what we're going to find is as we get down here, $.extend signaler with move shape. So move shape is the C# class that I created, and here's that move shape function that I call from the client side. So that was all done for me. So we generate a client-side proxy. This is very similar to the client-side proxies you'd be used to with AzureMX Web Services or WCF if you were using a script manager way back in the day or if you're using script managers today, and it generates a client-side proxy for you that lets you call the server stuff in a fairly straightforward manner. So that is the hubs-level API. What does that give us? That gives us the ability for the client, let's go back to this one, for the client to call server methods, just like we did here, hub.moveshape, and for the server, more interestingly, for the server to call client methods. So we saw clients.shapeMoved gets called by the server, and I could obviously put more clients in here if I want to. So let's do that. I've got a slightly more built-out version here. Let me comment this out. And I'm going to run this one up. Let me close these. And let's run this version up. So we saw with a web client, let's put another one of these over here. Let's put that one there. Fire up another one of these, put that in there. Put that one over there. So this one now, I'm counting the number of connections. So that number 2 represents that I now have 2 connections. But I have a different sort of client in this one. I have a desktop client as well. So rather than just being web browsers, I'm going to fire up a WPF app. So let's go into here. Here's MoveShape Desktop. Here it is. So I'm going to bring that across. And now if I pick it up in here and move it, you can see that's moving in both the browser and the desktop at the same time. And if I do this really quickly, I'll make someone throw up. So that's kind of cool. So I showed you a JavaScript client. We also have a .NET client. So the code, funnily enough, looks pretty similar because we want the experience to be somewhat the same no matter what sort of client you're using. So if I go into the code behind for that main window and have a look at the code here, what do we have? Well, we have var hub connection equals new hub connection. Now, in JavaScript, I went $.connection.hub, so it's not really that much different. And then I create a proxy to move shape. So unlike in the JavaScript world where we can just add a reference to some magic URL and then the runtime sends down a magic JavaScript file for us, we don't really have that in the .NET world. I can't just tell the server to send me now on a new .NET assembly and load it. I mean, I could, but that would be pretty stupid. Well, not stupid, but pretty crazy. So what we do here is we manually create a proxy. So now I have my hub, which is synonymous with the hub I had in the JavaScript client. And then rather than having a method on the hub, because in .NET we can't just add methods to types really, really easily, we've got a generic on method here. So I'm saying on shape moved. So when the shape moved message comes from the server, the remote sort of method invocation message with these strongly typed parameters, so I've got my connection ID, my X and my Y still, and that's a string, a double, and a double, then go ahead and dispatch that back onto the UI thread because it's WPF and everything is asynchronous, and go ahead and move that shape on the canvas. Though similarly, I've also got the client count changed. I told you that I was incrementing the client number, and I'll show you how we do that on the server in just a moment. So I'm listening for that as well, and then updating the text box to show how many clients are connected. Then I asynchronously wait for the connection to start. So now I'm using part of .NET 4.5 and C# 5. I've got the await hub connection.start. So start actually returns a task. We can see in there, it says usage await start. So that's an asynchronous method, just like it is in JavaScript. But in JavaScript, we have promises and callbacks. So I say .start, .done, and then I pass a callback in rather than use a promise, rather than use a wait, sorry. And then I've got some ghetto sort of draggable behavior that I created for WPF that sort of looks like the jQuery UI one. So I can say shape is draggable, and when it gets dragged, run this lambda and give me the current left and top position of that shape. So that's kind of cool. How did I track how many clients we're concerned. So Signaler not only gives you this broadcast capability, but we have connect and disconnect intrinsics built into the framework. So we track how many connections there are. Well, not how many as such, but we raise events when a connect takes place, and we raise events when a disconnect takes place, when a client goes away. So if I go to this version of this hub, let's go over to MoveShape Hub, you can see I'm implementing two more interfaces this time. My hub is implementing iConnected and iDisconnect, the two things you need to implement if you want to be told in your hub when a user connects and when they disconnect. So then I'm using a static concurrent dictionary as my state. So this is the state of my web application. I'm going to store the number of people that are currently using Signaler on my app by shoving them in a concurrent dictionary. Now, I'm using a concurrent dictionary because this is static and it's in a web application, which means it's going to be multiple requests on different threads hitting this dictionary at the same time. So I have to use a thread-safe version like concurrent dictionary. I could also use locks and things like that if I wanted to, but this is much, much easier. So then I have my MoveShape method we saw before, and then I have these other methods down here which are to do with connect and disconnect. So connect will be called whenever, obviously, someone connects, and then I'm going to go ahead and just call try add on that concurrent dictionary, and then I'm going to broadcast out to the world clients.clientCountChanged the current count of that dictionary. So now I know how many people are connected to this app based on how many things are in that dictionary, because similarly, when disconnect happens, I go ahead and remove that connection ID from the dictionary. So you can also see here that every single connection in Signaler gets a unique ID. Now, what I haven't shown you here is how you go about dealing with user to connection ID management. The relationship from an application user to connections is one to many. So when I come and connect to this application, what we're going to see is the count goes up, as we expect. So here's that one. Here's that one. Here's my desktop. If I hit F5 in here, really quick, and of course this doesn't work anymore because we have graceful disconnect and we do that immediately. This used to work. When you hit F5, you'll note that the number was going down to 2, and then we'll go back up to 3 again. You can see that very, very quickly. Oh, it's going up to 4 very quickly on the right-hand side. Oh, there's 4. So I've got a bung connection in there somewhere, a connection that's hanging around. That's actually good. So when I hit F5, what happens is the initial connection stays there, and then because you refresh the page, all the JavaScript runs again, and you get a new connection. Because the way browsers and sort of web servers work is they have an underlying TCP connection with keep alive, and the connection, even when you close the browser, will tend to stay there for a little bit. It doesn't go away immediately. You can see this in perf counters if you ever do ASP.NET load testing. And you can see the connections will stay around for a while until the TCP stack goes, oh, you know, I haven't heard anything from this connection in a while. Let me send a packet and see if it's still there. And that'll go on and on and on until it finally decides, nope, this connection is no longer there anymore, and it'll kill and terminate the underlying connection. So in Signaler, we have a similar thing. We have a concept of a graceful disconnect and a disgraceful disconnect. So a graceful disconnect is where when the browser is refreshed or the window closes, we send a packet to the server, if we can, saying, hey, this connection is being disconnected. In which case, we'll fire the disconnect event and my code here will run. In the case where that packet wasn't able to get to the server for whatever reason, then we have a background thread that runs in your app that loops through all known connections. We keep a very, very small piece of state in memory that's just all the connections that are currently connected to this server. And then every 20 seconds, it loops through those, asks IIS, is that connection still connected? And if it isn't, checks the time it was last seen against a threshold, and if that threshold has been exceeded, then it fires the disconnect event and destroys the connection. Now, connect and disconnect is a really, really, really hard thing to get right in web applications, as you can see. So we already have a bug here because this is still 4, and it should have gone down to 3 by now because I was hammering on the keyboard with F5, F5, F5. So this is something that we're still working on, but it gets better with every single release. So 0.5.1, which we brought out earlier this week, added the support for the graceful disconnect so that the numbers will go down immediately, assuming. So if I close this, you can see that went down to 3. And I'm not sure, does the .NET client do it? Let's see. No, the .NET client doesn't do it yet. The JavaScript client does do it. And so we're continuing to work on these things because that's a really, really difficult thing to get right just because of the way networks work. But you have to track that stuff yourself. So if you have the concept of people who are signed in your application, obviously you don't want to identify them via a connection ID. In fact, it's a GUID by default. You're going to have some username and password that people log in with. What you need to do is store somewhere in your database a mapping of username to connections so that you can know Damien is currently logged in on connection 1, 2, 3, and 4. Because I might have multiple tabs open, I might have my phone open, I might have a desktop app open as well, and they might all be hitting the same app. And so it's always a one-to-many relationship. And then as the disconnect events come in, you clear out those connections from the table. There's a really good example of an app that does this that we host up in the cloud. It's actually on Azure, and it's called Jabber. So Jabber, let me find the URL. Jabber is kind of an IRC clone-ish built with Signaler. So it's a massive chat application. You can see it has multiple rooms. Here's the Signaler room over here. There's a bunch of people talking at the moment. I'm back and on stage. And they're going to freak out now and put naughty things in there or something like that. I don't know. It has some other nice features. You can paste in Twitter URLs, and it'll go ahead and... Yeah, don't show that. I really shouldn't go into general chat. It's really a bad place to be. I was just asking for trouble. But you can paste in like images, URLs to an image, and we'll automatically embed it. If you paste in a YouTube link, as you saw, it'll automatically embed that. So this is a really nice example of a multi-user application where we use Signaler and then we also log in. So I didn't have to sign in because I've already signed in before. I actually signed into this app using Twitter. And then in the database, they store sort of the mapping between users, the mapping between users and connections. So I'm going to close that now and not tempt fate any longer. So the source for that is available up on GitHub. You can go and see how a large-scale Signaler application is actually built. So what other things are kind of interesting when it comes to Signaler? Well, let's go back and have a look at how these things actually get connected. So here it is. Here's Chrome. It's connected to my application. I'm going to fire up the network stack again, hit F5. Let's take a closer look at these connections. Did I kill my web server? There it is. Okay. Let's zoom in. So down here, note the first thing that happens is we have a negotiation connection is sent out. A negotiation request, sorry. The first thing that happens is we always make an AJAX request to the server saying, hey, I need to negotiate a real-time connection with you. And the server sends back a payload. The payload looks like this. It gives us the URL that we need to connect to. Here's my connection ID. So here's that unique GUID. Then it sends back a flag saying, hey, there's a good chance that this server will support WebSockets. And so you should go ahead and try to connect with WebSockets. And I say try because WebSockets doesn't always work. While WebSockets is the promise of wonderful things, and there's all unicorns and rainbows and merry-go-rounds and great stuff like that, the reality is it really doesn't work very well in the real world. WebSockets really bastardizes what we know about HTTP. It takes the concept of a request and response and says, make a request and then leave the connection open forever and then just let the people talk to each other over that port for as long as they want to do. And funnily enough, a lot of the infrastructure of the internet doesn't like that. So you might have front-end load balancers, you might have reverse proxies, you might have a proxy in your enterprise, you might have caching servers, you might have any number of layers in between the browser and the server that decide that they don't want to let this WebSocket connection work. Or they might let it work for the first 10 seconds and then just arbitrarily put a bullet in its head and stop it working. And so we say, go ahead and try WebSockets. And if that doesn't work, then we start a process of falling back to lower fidelity transports, ones that may not work as well. Now, in this case, we can see we then made a connect request. Here it is, and here's the URL. So we go request, and this is a WebSocket URL. We can see the WS colon. So the browser is indeed trying WebSockets because this is Chrome. I'm on Windows 8 and it supports WebSockets. Now I could use IE10 and it does the exact same thing. So let's try this in IE10. I've got IE10 right here. Let's put that in. Let's come to the network tab and start capturing and hit refresh. And we'll see a very, very similar thing. You can see here that negotiate has taken place, but the IE10 network stack doesn't show WebSocket connections, unlike the Chrome one. So I know it's using WebSockets because there's no request after negotiate, which is great. So if you're using Fiddler, you could see that request going through. So I'm going to jump back to Chrome because we can actually see this request coming through. And then the response from the server in this case is nothing because this is an open connection. I have a WebSocket running now. Now, if you want to actually see the traffic running over the WebSocket, you can use Canary. Anyone know what Canary is? Have you used Canary? That's this special version of Chrome. That's sort of like the nightly dev channel build something something or other. Now, it does, in its latest versions, have WebSocket packet inspection. So I'm going to run up the same thing. Let's move that over there so I can actually move my shapes around so we get some traffic. Let's put some traffic. There we go. Let's do this. Let's come over to network. Let's hit F5. Let's do that again. And let's find, there it is. This is my WebSocket. So interestingly enough, let me just, oh, that one, this one. Note the response from the server. So here's my connect. This is a WebSocket request, the WS. And the response was 101 switching protocols. So this is the server replying saying, yes, I understand WebSockets. Let's upgrade this connection to a WebSocket connection. So if I click on that, here's all the WebSocket frames. So Canary actually tells us what direction they came. We can see that the server is just broadcasting frames down to the client. And if I came up and actually move the shape around in here, now there's a kind of a weird button. Oh, no, that's actually showing it now. Do I scroll down? No, you have to switch back between them. And now you'll see that there's a bunch of arrows going in the other direction. Here we go. There's one there. There's one there. So I was sending WebSockets up to the server, left to right. Nice way of being able to see. Actually, we'll stay down there because it's interesting to have a look at what type of stuff's being sent over the wire. So this is what Signaler sends. Everything that you send in Signaler is a string. Now, you can send complex types from the server, and we just serialize them down to JSON. So as long as it can be serialized to JSON using JSON.NET, which is what we use by default, then we'll send it down over Signaler. And then we wrap it in a whole bunch of our own guff. So we wrap it in like a framing protocol that our specific client understands, and then that's what gets sent over the wire. So that's what you can see here. There's a state object that we're telling what hub. So hub is move shape, and the method we want to invoke is move shape. So you can see how we do that remote invocation because we just send all the parameters up to the server, and then we use reflection to invoke it on the server, which is kind of nice. Okay, so that is WebSockets, but what about other transports? What about browsers that don't support WebSockets? So let me switch to a browser that doesn't support WebSockets. Let me flip into compatibility mode over here. And let's see if this demo is going to fail spectacularly. Let me hit F5, and it looks like I'm actually getting an error over here. I wonder why that is. That would be a shame. Let's have a look. Let's try that again. JavaScript debugger. Oh, haha. Now, this is a really good point. So, as I said, we use JSON. And so, by default, look, we've actually thrown a nice, helpful exception, which is in the Signaler library. If I do that again, let's do no, hit F5, say yes. Signaler, no JSON parser found. So, because I switched into compatibility mode, IE7 didn't have native JSON support. And so to support this, you need to use a library like JSON2. That's JSON2.js. You can get it on NuGet. So rather than do that, I'm just going to ignore all of this and switch into IE9 mode because it does have native JSON support. And start capturing again. Oops, say no, no, no. Hit F5. Right. So that's better. So now let's have a look at the network frames that happened this time. So after the negotiate, here's that negotiate request. Immediately after that, we get a connect request, but this time the transport is different. So the transport name in this case is something called Forever Frame. And so beyond WebSockets or after WebSockets, we have three transports that we try and use. The first one is called Server Sent Events, otherwise known as Event Source. It's an older web standard for streaming data from the server to the client over HTTP that Chrome, Opera, WebKit, Safari, Firefox, those browsers support, but IE never implemented support for it. So if you do this in Chrome on and you don't have WebSockets available, what you'll see is server sent events. In IE, versions less than 10 that don't support WebSockets, you're going to see forever frame. Forever frame is the technique of having a hidden iframe in your page, and then the request that iframe makes is to a page that only ever streams down script blocks. And the browser will very nicely of it just execute those script blocks as they arrive. And so we can use that to stream data down to the client because we can just stream down JavaScript and it'll continue to execute it, which is what this does for you under the covers. And then finally, if none of those things work, we fall down to a technique called long polling. And long polling is kind of the extension of polling. So polling is where you say, have you got data? No. Then you wait some interval, 3 seconds. Have you got any data? No. You wait another 3 seconds. Have you got any data? No. Wait another 3 seconds, and that goes on until you go, have you got data? Yes, I have data, and then you get data sent back. How many people have used polling in their applications? I'm sure a lot of people have. Okay. Long polling is a little bit different. You say, have you got data? And then the server doesn't respond until it does. So that connection just stays open. It hangs around until the server realizes it has data, something happens, and then it returns that data back to the client. The client processes it and then immediately sends another connection out. There's no delay. It says, have you got data again? The last data I got was X. And the server sits there and waits until there's data greater than X and then sends it down. And so it looks like you have a persistent connection because you've always got that connection open. It's also really good in terms of latency in that if you've got a long pole connection open and there's currently no data, as soon as data becomes available, so someone clicks a button in another form, it's going to immediately return because it was already connected. You don't have to wait for the next pole cycle for that client to get that data. So that's kind of nice. So we have WebSockets, service end events, forever frame, and long polling, which are supported. So let's move on. So quickly on WebSockets. So to get WebSocket support, the version of SignalR we released this week, 0.5.1, was the first version that came with WebSocket support in the box. So you saw there, I just NuGetted in that SignalR sample, which brought in SignalR 0.5.1, and I got WebSocket straight away. Now, that's because I'm running Windows 8. So in ASP.NET, to get WebSocket support, you need to have ASP.NET 4.5, and you need to be running on IIS 8. So Windows 8 ships with IIS 8, and Visual Studio 2012 RC ships with IIS Express 8, which is what I'm using here. So you can see the little icon down the bottom here. I'm using IIS Express, and this is IIS Express 8 because I'm using Visual Studio 2012 RC. IIS Express 8 on Windows 7 will not get WebSockets. You need to have Windows 8 on the server if you're using ASP.NET to get WebSockets. Okay? If you're not, then that try WebSockets flag that comes back from the negotiate will be false. Then we won't even try WebSockets. We'll just default to trying service end events and then walking back until we get one that works. Okay. So the next thing that most people ask once they've seen this, I mean, there are more features at the API level. I've shown you hubs. We also have a lower level API called connections, which is just more like a raw socket. You say open the socket, and then you send data and you receive data, and that's it. Whereas hubs obviously gives you this nice server methods, client methods, I can invoke either. So we do have lower level APIs available. But the big question most people then ask is, that, well, how does it scale? I have a web farm. How does this thing work in a web farm? Okay, well, let's have a look at how that works. So the version that we... 0.5, we added support for web farm. As I said, that whole connect-disconnect intrinsic is really, really difficult to do, let alone on one server, on two servers, let alone on, sorry, on one server, let alone on two servers. So let's close these down. I want to bring up that move shape one again. And I'm going to come down to the console here, and I have a little script that's going to fire up my web farm, so to say. So web farm in a box. One of these tabs, this one here. Okay. Here, start farm. So all this is doing is starting two instances of IIS Express, one on the left and one on the right. And those instances are running that same application we were just looking at, move shape. So I'm going to go ahead and fire up a browser. We'll put that one over here. And we'll resize that one up so we can see it's on that web server. Move it up there. And we'll go to localhost colon 8090. And we should see one of those consoles, this one over here. So let's go to move shape. So this, you can see this server over here is the one that's serving those requests. So let's open up another one. And rather than having a load balancer, all I'm going to do is fire up two browsers that go to different ports. Okay? It's effectively a web farm, it's just that I don't have a load balancer in front. So this one's going to port 8091. And we'll see that the left-hand side now, that web server is firing up. So if I try and do this now, we'll see that nothing works because you know these two browsers are in different worlds. They're not talking to each other. The servers are completely different processes. They're different instances of IIS Express. So the SignalR messages only ever live inside of that process. So the whole point of web farm support is we need a way for messages to get from one server to another. So that clients connected to one server get messages from clients connected to another. So how do we do that? Well, we need a backplane. We need a message bus backplane. And we ship two message bus backplanes for doing web farms. One of them is Windows Azure Service Bus. So if you're running in Azure, Windows Azure Service Bus support is there. And I believe Brady is going to demonstrate that now in a couple of weeks at the Europe Tech Ed. I am going to show you Redis. So Redis is an in-memory database that does PubSub and persistence. But for the purposes of SignalR, we're just going to use it for PubSub. So I'm going to go into my app start. I've got an app start method here already. I've just got the assembly pre-app start method attribute commented out. And you can see that all I'm doing is I'm going into SignalR's globalhost. So this is SignalR.globalhost.dependencyresolver. And then off that, we have an extension method called useRedis. Into that, I simply have to pass the address and the port of the Redis server. If there's a password, I pass it in and then give it an event key. So for this is PubSub, so I need some event key on Redis that it can use to shard these messages. So I've done that, but I haven't started my Redis server yet. So let's go and start my Redis server. I've got a different tab over here. So all I did to get Redis working is I went up to GitHub and I went to MS Open Tech. So MS Open Tech, who hasn't heard of MS Open Tech? A lot of people. Okay. So MS Open Tech is a wholly owned subsidiary of Microsoft that does open source. And that's all they do. So things like the announcement we made about ASP.NET MVC 4, Web API, Web Pages 2, Razor being open source, that's all done by MS Open Tech. So generally, you don't really see anything. Like, it's still Microsoft. It's just an owned subsidiary. But all the open source stuff sort of lives under here. And so up on GitHub, they have a port of Redis for Windows. So Redis is a very popular in-memory message, in-memory database for Linux and Mac. And they've ported it to Windows, run natively on Windows. So all I did, literally, was take this URL, went to the console, and typed git clone, that URL, opened the solution in Visual Studio, compiled it, it's C++, it's native, and then I went to the bin folder, or the debug folder, and I wrote start process Redis server. And that's it. That's all I had to do to get Redis going. I didn't have to do anything else. And so here it is. Redis is running. You can see that it's started up, and it's running on port 6379, which seems to be the default port. So now I have my two web servers, and I have my Redis server sitting right there. So let's go back to my app and make sure I'm using port 6379. I am. Let's build that again. And let's refresh these pages. Okay. Did that work? That. It's either I'm using the wrong one because I have multiple copies. What I want to see is this. Ah, here we go. Two clients connected. I need to do a rebuild. There we go. So you see on the Redis window here, it says two clients are connected now. That's my two web servers. And so now when I pick this up and move it across, we can see that we've got it moving on both monitors, on both browsers, even though these are on completely different servers. So this is how we get scale out using SignalR. Now, the astute of you will notice, however, that my connect count is wrong. Now, why is my connect count wrong? Who can tell me? It's different servers, and where was I storing it? In memory. Yeah. So Redis scale out with SignalR isn't a magic bullet for making your app just scale out. Of course, you still have to make sure that you haven't done things that are silly, like start up the Windows Phone emulator. What did I do that for? Like store state inside an in-memory store, like I've done here. So if I was going to do this properly, obviously I would need to put this in a database. All right? Or I could store it in Redis itself. Redis does have a persistence mechanism if I wanted to do that. But generally, you're going to have a database in SQL or something you're already running. You've got a users table. You can just shove that information in there, and now you've got a full user table of what the connections are. So, there we have WebFarm. Now, I'll just jump back into the API for a moment, because there's a couple of things I haven't touched on. People often ask, well, that's great, you're broadcasting to a lot of different people. What about broadcasting to an individual person? Well, I can do that. So inside a hub method, I've got the clients property. I also have the caller property. So the caller property is just the same as clients, except anything I do on here, so if I type do stuff, is going to get invoked just on the person who invoked this method. Okay, just that client. If I want to send to a specific client, like I have that connection ID and I want to send it to that person, I can just pass the connection ID in here. It's usually going to be a GUID. And then I can do the same thing. Okay, so that's how I would go to a specific client. Clients, index, syntax, and then whatever the connection ID is. And again, here I was storing the connection IDs in this concurrent dictionary. Generally, you'll store it in a database. You'll map it to a user. So when someone says send a message to Damien, you would look up the connection IDs for Damien, and you would send it through to those connection IDs. You can also send to groups. So you can have arbitrary groups of users, and you can broadcast to those groups just by doing something like that. The way you add people to groups is off hubs, there's a groups property, and you can just say add, and then you pass in the current connection ID, which is not in capitals, context.connection ID, and then the group that you want to add them to. And obviously, there's a remove method as well. So there's groups on any hub. You can say, here's all the people connected to my hub. I can segregate them into groups so that I can send messages specifically to individual groups, and I can store the connection ID so that I can send to individual connections as well. So if you look at an application like Jabber, which is that massive sort of chat application, all those different rooms were implemented as Signaler groups. So there's a database that stores a list of rooms that people has created, and then he creates Signaler groups with the same name as those rooms. And then when people say, I want to join that room, he puts their connection in that group. So that when he sends a message to a room, he sends it to the group, hence everyone gets the message. Does that make sense? Okay. So let's do the next thing that people generally ask. So they go, okay, that's great. I can call methods on the client. I've got adaptive transports, which is fantastic. So I get WebSockets if it's there. Falls back to something else if it isn't. I don't have to worry about it. I can do web farms. That's awesome. I can scale out to thousands of users. Prove it. How do I do scale testing? Like how far can we really, really make this thing go? So let's do a load test. How do we go about and actually load test something like this? So we actually have a performance harness that we use to do load testing of Signaler. Now, at this point, I will pause for a moment to talk about performance in general in Signaler. So in 0.5.1, with the performance rig that I have at home, which is a three-year-old Core i7-920, I believe, it's a three-year-old first-generation Core i7. So it's a pretty good machine, but it's 3 years old now. When I simulate 5,000 clients, I simulate 5,000 clients on a different machine, which we're going to do in just a moment, I can get about 30,000 sends a second through that server using Signaler, which isn't bad. It's not amazing, but it's pretty good. To give you an idea, if I was just to make ASP.NET requests to a Hello World handler on the same machine, I'd get about 20,000 requests a second. So we're still getting 50% more throughput than we would if we were just making requests for every single data call, like if you were doing polling. Okay, so we're already way, way above that. But we have a core issue in the middle of Signaler architecture at the moment. Like, we're still in pre-alpha stages. And in 0.6, the next major release, we're going to do a re-architecture of the middle, and we hope to push those numbers up to at least triple what they are now. Hopefully, we're going to get to six digits. So let's see what we can push my little laptop to. This is a three-year-old laptop. It's a Core 2 Duo. The RAM doesn't matter because I'm not going to have enough connections really to worry about. It's 8 gig of RAM, but I'm going to be using 50 meg. It doesn't really matter. But the CPU is really what we're going to see. So let's go ahead and do that. So I'm going to use our performance harness called Flywheel, and I'm going to use WCAT to drive load. So let's talk a little bit about those two things. If I go up to GitHub and I go to Signaler, we have a bunch of repositories under Signaler. We have the core Signaler library itself, but we have this other one called Flywheel. So you can clone this, bring it down, which is what I've done here. Let's bring it up, and I'm going to run it. And what you get is a dashboard. And you can see there's like a real-time graph that's showing me the number of sends going through the system at any one time. For people who are interested just in doing real-time graphs with Signaler, look at the source code for this. I mean, if you've got any other use, like a stock thing or any sort of dashboard you have, this is using a library called HiCharts. It's a jQuery plugin which does nice vector graphs, and I just update it every second from the server. And it also dumps out raw statistics about what's going on the server at the moment from a Signaler point of view. So generally, we would be using this next to Perfmon. We'd have a bunch of ASP.NET counters up and running with Perfmon. So the interesting things it's tracking is the number of connects, so how many clients, connects and disconnects. And then over on the left-hand side, what I'm really interested in is the number of sends per second and receives, like how many messages am I pumping through Signaler per second. And then I can actually go and broadcast stuff out from here. So we need some clients, because at the moment I have no clients, no one's listening. So let's go down and use WCAT. Let me show you that. So WCAT, you want to search for WCAT64, because I'm assuming you've all got 64-bit machines, or the servers you're doing this on will be 64-bit. WCAT stands for Web Capacity Analysis. Thank you, Brady. Web Capacity Analysis Tool. It's put out by the IIS team, and it's a way of generating load for IIS, or any HTTP server, really. It's a native command line tool and a bunch of scripts. It's really finicky to use, but it is well documented. And once you get it up and running and set up your settings, it's fairly straightforward to use, as we'll see. So you download that, you read the documentation to get it set up, and then you come back to the Signaler GitHub repo, and you go into Crank. So here's Crank, And inside Crank, we have this WCAP folder. And this contains all the settings files that I'm about to use to make WCAT hit the server and make all this load. So let's do that. So I've got my console here. I've got my flywheel running already. Let's minimize that. Let's bring flywheel back up. Where is it? There it is. Let's pull that out, and we'll pin that over there for the moment. I don't need this one. Let's get rid of that. Okay. So I need to generate load. So I've cloned that Crank repository here, and I'm in the WCAT folder. So I've got a batch file that's already got everything set up for me. I'm just going to run wcat.bat. Let's zoom out, and that doesn't work because I didn't do it right. So let's do that again and do this is PowerShell, so I have to hit tab. There we go. So now I've got WCAT running. And what we'll see, let's bring this across, is it starts starting up one virtual client every so many microseconds, is I'm starting to get connects. So here they are. Connects are now coming into the server. I've got this many clients that are connected. And as I get up to 1,000, I've got this set up to simulate 1,000 clients. Here we go, we've hit 1,000 clients. I'm going to come over to here, let's maximize this, and I'm going to start broadcasting at 5 messages a second. So now what I'm doing is the server is broadcasting 5 messages per second to 1,000 clients. So what we would hope to see in a perfect world where there was absolutely no overhead is 5,000 messages a second. And what we're seeing, as you can see from the graph there, is pretty good. We're getting pretty close to 5,000 messages a second. The actual number is hovering between 4.7 and 5.1, depending on whether it's coming up and down. So I think this test runs for about 90 seconds in the scenario file. That'll continue to run. You can have fun watching what it's doing. Now, interestingly enough, the process doing the most work, pretty graphs are expensive. So don't run that flywheel dashboard on the same machine that you're running the server on, okay? Obviously, for the purpose of the demo, it's perfectly fine. I'm still doing 5,000 messages a second without any problem. But the web server is only using 40% CPU. So theoretically, I could probably do double that on this box if I put the clients on a separate machine. So I had another laptop. I ran WCAT on the other laptop, have a dedicated network switch in between them, gigabit, please. Make sure it's gigabit. And then generate the load that way and run flywheel on a different box, a third box that you observe with, and you should be able to easily hit those sort of numbers. Incidentally, on my rig at home, with this is a 32-byte message size. You can see over here, 32-byte broadcast size. If I change that to 4K, I can generally saturate the gigabit NIC in the machine that's generating the load. And that's always a really, really good sign that your perf load, your load test is getting to where you want to be. If you can saturate a gigabit NIC before you saturate your server, that's good. Generally means you have to add more NICs to your server so you can get more load into it. And obviously your data center has to support that much traffic and all the rest of it. But that's a really, really good sign. Now obviously in a real world application, you're going to be doing a lot more than just having a connection that you broadcast stuff over. So the same, the rules for load testing and scaling out an ASP.NET application still apply. This is just talking about the signaler aspect. But it's a very, very interesting thing to know. And now you know how you can go ahead and replicate these results yourself and sort of see what it does. So they've all stopped. There's no one connected now. And if I scroll back over, what we should see is they've all these disconnects. All the disconnects haven't happened yet. So actually, has it stopped or am I just lying? Let's have a look. Okay, it has stopped. So what we should see within about 20 seconds is we'll suddenly get 1,000 disconnects happen, if this is working. It did just before. And we'll see that background thread kicks in my application, realizes all those connections are gone. There they are. So the disconnects just happened, and now I have no connected clients. So we get that connection cleanup logic happened. All the memory will be freed up. The connections are no longer being tracked by the signaler internals. And your disconnect event would have fired if you had it on your code. So there we go. That's Flywheel. Any questions on the perf stuff before I move on? The question is, does Signaler work on mobile applications? Yes. Thank you, sir. That's a fantastic segue. Let's jump onto GitHub because I've shown you the JavaScript client and I've shown you the .NET client. But we have other clients for Signaler as well. So if we go and look at the source code, we have a Silverlight client. So if you're writing Silverlight applications, you can have them talk to your Signaler endpoint. Because we have Silverlight, we also have Windows Phone 7. We saw the .NET client because I had a WPF app. There's also a WinRT client. So if you're doing Metro applications, whether they're... Now, if you're doing Metro JavaScript applications, you can actually just use the jQuery JavaScript client. It will work. But if you want to use a native WinRT component, we have one of those as well. The community has contributed so far a client for iOS. So there is a native iOS client. There is a MonoTouch client and a MonoDroid client that have also been contributed. I believe someone contributed a Java client. The plans for us, as in the ASP.NET team, now that we're going to build this thing and take it through to a version 1, are to support as many of those clients as we can for version 1. Because obviously, a technology like this is a lot more useful the more applications can connect to it. So expect to see us not only support these clients, but also things like iOS and Android once we start moving SignalR closer to a 1.0 release. Any other questions on the perf stuff or anything else before I jump on? No? Okay, cool. So, as I said, the next version 0.6, I'm just going to wrap up now. So if anyone has any questions, feel free to hang around because questions usually are the really, really good bit. 0.6 is going to be coming out soon in the next month or so. If you want to see what's coming in the next version, jump up onto GitHub, go into the issues list. This is where we track all of the work that's being done. If you find any issues, please log them. And then you can jump into milestones, and as we get closer to a release, we'll create a milestone for it and start putting issues in there. So 0.5.x represents the next point release. We just did 0.5.1. So 0.5.2, we still have 12 issues open, and then we have 44 issues open in the backlog. So if you want a feature that you don't see in the backlog, please go ahead and log it in here, and we will queue it up and do our best to get that done for you. In terms of the future of the library, so it started out as a skunkworks sort of after-hours project of myself and David Fowler, another guy on the ASP.NET team, and we recently announced that we're actually going to pull this in to become a fully developed and fully supported ASP.NET component. So just like the other WebStack components, so MVC and Web API and the web pages and Razor, SignalR will be an open source, continue to be an open source library, but now developed and maintained and supported by the ASP.NET team. And we hope to have a 1.0 release out before the end of this year so that you can go ahead and use this in your apps now. Now, I know people are using it in their apps already, but because it's pre-beta and we're still making changes, we reserve the right to make breaking changes from release to release. We haven't made that many. I think Brady's complained a few times that we make changes and break his demos and stuff, but we're generally pretty good, and it is actually quite well documented. If you go to the wiki, there is a bunch of documentation about how to get this stuff up and running. For hubs in particular, a lot of people have a lot of questions about quick start and hubs. You can come into here, and there's a fairly good quick start here, and then there's a very good, hubs on the server that tells you about all interesting things, like how do I broadcast to things over a hub when I have code that's not inside the actual hub itself? Like, how do I do it from outside the context of a hub? You can absolutely do that. There's an example of how to do that right there. There's also API documentation, so you can go to signalr.net and go to the official source there and hit API, and we actually document all the API. And we're improving this as we go along, obviously, as an open source project with limited resources. We do what we can as we go. So, if you want to contact me and ask me questions, my name is Damien Edwards. I always forget to do this at the end of my talks. So here it is, Damien Edwards, DamienEdwards.com. You can grab me on Twitter, send me an email, Damien.Edwards@Microsoft.com, or send me a tweet. Thank you very much for your time. If you have questions, please stand around and come up and use the mics and ask them so everyone can hear them, and I'm happy to answer them. But otherwise, thanks for TechEd, and have a really great rest of the day. Anyone have any questions? None. You're all going to go eat ice cream and stand by the pool. Okay, I got one here too. So the question was what, sorry? Yes. So Jabber is actually running in an Azure web role. So this is actually running in an Azure web role. It's a single instance, but you can scale out to multiple instances using Service Bus. So someone has written a caching scale-out provider, but I haven't looked at it, and so I wouldn't trust it yet. Writing the scale-out providers is actually fairly difficult to do properly, but we are investigating using the caching to do so. Oh, look, someone's putting in a GIF. Isn't that nice of them? Let me just scroll up here. Yes, .NET 4.0 and up. Yes. You need 4.5.4 WebSockets. Uh, the question is around, is there a privacy concern? That is not, maybe, but that's not a SignalR specific thing. If your website is doing something that may not be obvious to the user but with their information, then that's, you know, I'm not an expert in that, but that's... Right. No, I don't think this adds anything different to that. If you're doing that anyway, you need to be thinking about privacy in general. So the question is, can you handle auth between the clients and the hub? So what we do is we flow the principle from the underlying host up through into the connect. So in the hubs, if I come back into here and look at hubs, in here there is a context, and on that you'll get the user. And so that's an iPrinciple. And so in ASP.NET, that's going to be the currently logged in user. And so if you want to do authentication, and you can do it right there. So we are looking at ways to extend that because people want to be able to do things like they can do an MVC where they can have an attribute here and say, like, allow role, you know, foo or something in here. And currently, that's not really easy to do. So we're going to look at adding some hooks so that you could build stuff like that. Yep. Yes. No. So on mobile, so in a mobile web application, I think the iPhones support WebSockets. I think. Actually, I don't know. I really don't know. It'll use it if the browser supports it. If you're using the Silverlight or Windows Phone 7 client, it definitely doesn't. It only supports long polling.
Is there any customization we can do on that long polling? How long?
Yes, so the long polling transport, you can define how long the gap between retry is. So that rather than reconnecting immediately, you can tell it to wait a few seconds if you want to.
I was seeing some video and it showed me like you and the other guy who developed SignalR.
Yes.
You developed SignalR and after that you joined Microsoft? Or
no.
You were at Microsoft?
No, we were at Microsoft when we started it. Yeah. Okay. Who's next?
In the web role.
No, so web roles today don't support WebSockets because they're .NET 4. But you can use a durable VM, the new things that just came out. There's a 2012 image, so you could get WebSockets in Azure using that.
Until
4.5 gets into web roles. Yep. Who's next?
Will
not work on 3.5 and will never work on 3.5. It uses the task parallel library, uses all the asynchrony features that were added in 4.0, and there is no way we're porting that to 3.5. So. Yeah, no, that's just far too much work. Yeah, sorry, 4.0 only.
Do you have some kind of timeout mechanism in your client?
Yes, so the question is about timeout. So up until version 0.5 and including 0.5, by default connections would time out after 2 minutes, and then they would just reconnect. Now what we do is we have keep alive, and so there's two options. You can either use a keep alive or a timeout. So by default in 0.5.1, the server will send packets down to the client every 30 seconds, I think. It'll just send a ping to keep the connection open because a lot of load balancers will kill a connection if nothing happens on it, and we disable timeout. But that availability is still there if you find that the timeout works better in your environment than the keep alive. So that's absolutely there. You can change the timeout value.
Like JavaScript handlers in case you get a timeout? Or...
Mm-hmm. So there's a client-side timeout as well. So when you're going through and we're trying to different transports, if, for instance, we try and establish... a WebSocket connection and it takes more than 3 seconds to come back, we consider it failed and we move on to the next one.
Yeah, and do you ever get thrashing when two clients are disagreeing about, for instance, location of the box? If they're on different sides of the screen and they're sending back different numbers because they're off by a certain amount?
I don't know. I don't really understand the question, but we can talk about that offline if you want. All right. This side again? Yeah, so WebSockets is just a socket. In fact, it even supports binary. A SignalR doesn't support binary because we have to support binary transports that are just string-based. But WebSockets itself is just literally like a TCP socket. So, I mean, if you think about HTTP, ultimately there's a TCP socket open between you and the server, and then on top of that you do HTTP gets and requests. But WebSockets kind of lets you go, I'm going to make an HTTP request, but then after that I want to talk to the server over the raw socket. And so you can send back whatever you like. Do you have a question?
Okay.
It doesn't use any because it's still just one instance.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so Jabber manages to run without worrying about any type of... It's actually running on an extra small instance. So it's like 760 mega RAM, shared CPU, gets a couple hundred users at once and doesn't have any problems. So. The shape example is already available, actually. So if you go up to my GitHub repository, there it is, Signal or Move Shape Demo. It's right there. Cool. If you know, so Windows 8 is only required for WebSocket support on the server. Signaler itself only requires .NET 4, so you'll need Visual Studio 2010 on Windows XP, really, is the lowest. But if you want WebSocket support, you have to deploy to a server that's running Windows 8. Windows 20, IIS 8, Windows Server 2012. Will only run on Windows 8, correct. Awesome, there you go. So the person who asked about WebSockets on mobiles, if you're running iOS 4.2, you'll get WebSocket support. That's cool. Anyone else?
Is there an issue with Redis with redundancy? Is it only one server?
That's a really good question. I'm not a Redis expert. My understanding is that Redis supports a master-slave functionality, and I know nothing about it. So I'd just be guessing. But at the moment, I've just been running it with a single Redis endpoint. But my understanding is you can set up a master-slave sort of cluster, and then you would get redundancy if the first one goes down. It's not that different, really. In fact, we're looking at supporting an end service bus as a way to do scale-out or mass transit. At the end of the day, the core of Signaler is based on the principles of PubSub. So we just need a message bus that we can send stuff on. And the two that we've written so far are the service bus ones and the Redis ones. It's just JSON. We always serialize and wrap everything as JSON. Yep. Very easy. Message ordering, great question. So yes, in order for long polling to work, or all of them to work, because we support reconnect, so if the underlying transport breaks, your connection will still be alive because what we do is it establishes a reconnect phase, it starts going through reconnect, and then on the server we buffer messages, which is why we need this scale-out message bus. So we'll keep messages in memory for up to 20 seconds so that when the client reconnects and says, give me all the messages since message 1234, we can go, oh, we have message 1236, so let me give you the last three messages. And they'll be ordered, yes. We guarantee message order at the moment with the stuff that we have.
Clients can get notification
of
disconnect?
Yes. Yep, so on the client side, there is a connect event, a reconnect event, and a disconnect event.
Cool. Hey,
so, yep, if you go up to the Signaler repo, let's go to the source. Where's GitHub? That one. So if you clone the Signaler repo, it has a samples folder. Yeah. And you go into hosting ASP.NET samples. And in hubs, you just run this app, and there's a bunch of samples there. Okay.
Now, can you actually run that
example
on this server?
Okay, absolutely. In fact, that's what I sort of started trying to do. Let me do that. Let me find it. Let me run that. Okay, so that's sort of a raw connection, so we can just, you put stuff in and broadcast it. You can have it echo it back to just you. So with multiple browsers, that would only be seen by me. You can add to a group, so you can say, like, group one, join that group, and then I can say broadcast hello to group one, and that'll go to that group. If we come back, there's streaming. So this is a background thread that I kicked up on application start that's just pumping out the date and time to the server. There's a drawing pad that someone wrote. So if I do something like this, this is a canvas, so I can draw in here, and it's in both sides. What else have we got? There's some that just demonstrate like everything you can do. So demo hub, if you look at the code, demonstrates pretty much everything you can do with a hub. You can return asynchronous methods. You can return methods that throw exceptions, and we'll wrap them and throw them in the JavaScript client. You can return dynamics. We've got a thread that gets fired off on the server and then pumps message down to the client. There's actually a synchronized state object in hubs I didn't show you either. So this client state here, we have a background thread that's just sitting in a loop and incrementing the current state value, and that gets synchronized between the server and the client, which is kind of cool as well. I've done that again. What else have we got? We've got the connection status. So this is one that you would use to sort of learn how connect and disconnect works. So if I come in here, you can see that I got a new person who connected. And if I hit F5, you get that one disconnected. So that's the connection ID. And you can F5 in here, so that one left over there. So give you an idea of how that works. And there's this. Chat is basically Jabber. It's the beginning of Jabber. So chat is what Jabber came from. And then there's HubPing, which is kind of like a little benchmark tool. It's kind of funny. So you can basically say, I want you to do 1,000 requests, 1,000 echoes as fast as you possibly can, and then report the how long it took. So you can say, hit me, and it gives you how long it took in milliseconds to do that. Or you can say, hit us, and it'll hit all the connections. So you can just sort of do a very simple idea of how long things are, like the latency round trip between the server and the client. So yeah, they're good for looking at the code and seeing how things are done. And then Jabber is the other one, obviously. No, no, you have to. We don't actually have this running anywhere. Okay. You just clone the repo and then, or download the zip file and do it that way.
Thank you very much.
Not a problem. I don't know. Don't know who that is. Might have been me, but I didn't have any hair. So. Okay. Anything. So, I mean, people are using this for all types of stuff. Any time in any of your applications where someone has to hit F5 because they want to get updates, you could have been using this. Any time that you are currently polling to refresh a part of the page, you could be using this. And hopefully, those two things, you keep those in mind, you'll find infinite possibilities for it. I mean, the classic ones are like dashboards of graphs and things that change in real time. Auctions and if you've got ordering systems and billing systems, you can show sort of real-time statuses of queues of, of work and information and stuff like that. But there are people doing much more advanced stuff too, which is kind of cool. So. Yep. Multi-user. Yep. Absolutely. So there's a combination of those things. Other times you might have something where you've got a completely different system and then you want to have an application that is alerted in real time to when those things happen. Or the user kicks off something asynchronously and you want to report back progress. You could certainly do that with something like this as well. Yes. Absolutely. Perfect. Yes, you could absolutely do that. Yep, absolutely. So there's actually another sample that one of the other guys does, which is airline prices. And he has a list of airline prices with like the shopping side and there's an admin side. And the admin comes in and changes the price and it changes in real time in the in the page. So the admin screen, you mean? So the admin screen? Yeah, absolutely. So when you would build that however you normally build it, if that's just a traditional post request sort of application, that's fine. Somewhere in the server for that app, you'll have code that uses Signaler to push updates to some other screen via a hub.
What I'm saying is, would the payload be part of Signaler, or would that just be something for JavaScript to say, this aircraft thing has changed, Ajax back to get the details?
That is a good question. So this comes to how you actually architect your app. So if you have an existing application, the least amount of work you can do is put Signaler in just as a ping notification system. And so then whenever an update is available, the server just pings the client and says, hey, there's new data, and then it just makes an Ajax call. And a lot of people do that because it's really, really easy. But then when you go, well, actually, let's integrate Signaler in at an architectural level, then you can start actually sending the objects over Signaler itself. Right. Yep. So a lot of people do that way. I've seen cool samples where people have an entity, like they have apps where multiple people might be editing the same record at the same time, like the same form. And so then as you're editing the form, it shows you who else is editing different fields in real time. So you can see this field change, and so it'll change in front of you, and you'll get a username of who just changed it, stuff like that. So.
Well, my question may not be so long after all, but are there online ordering providers that are
restaurants. Right now, restaurants are constantly pinging in the pull orders now. And we always want to push models. Would
yep.
Be a good,
absolutely.
Event simpler than the current WCF stuff?
Yeah, I think so. So it depends on what your client is and what your needs are, but if all you need to be able to do is do this type, that type of push information, then Signaler is a perfect fit for that.
Okay.
So,
and does it work on older versions of Windows?
Yes. So in the client, in the server and the client, absolutely. So on the server side, everything but WebSockets will work all the way down to IIS6. And for...
On the client side, will it go down as far as...
IE6.
XP?
Yeah. So IE8 on XP, or IE7 or IE6.
Does the client have to be running IIS, or can it just be a...
No. So the client's not running IIS at all. They just run a...
server, you're in IIS.
Yes.
Yes,
I think it would be much simpler to get going than doing a similar thing with WCF.
It's worth waiting for a couple months versus trying to do with WCF.
Potentially. I mean, the quick way is to prototype something now using SignalR and see what if you can spend a day or two putting it in and seeing what it looks like, then you'll get a better answer than I can give you here. So.
Okay, thank
yeah.
you very much.
Cool.
Can you kick someone from the hub?
We don't give you a method that... do we give you an abort? I think we do have an abort method now. I think we do. I've never used it. Do we have an abort method? That's a really good question. I'm not sure that we do. I mean, it'd be very easy for you to add it to your own app, obviously. You can just send a message to your client-side hub, and that stops the connection, so that's easy because it's a stop method. I'm not sure if we actually have a server-side way of forcing a connection to close. That's a really good question. If we don't... So Jabber absolutely has kick,
okay.
But it doesn't kill the connection because it just kicks you from that room. It just removes you from that group.
But
if you want to actually kill the connection dead,
yeah.
Like call stop on it basically, I'm not sure you can do that from the server.
If they come back, they're going to get a new connection ID.
Correct. Because they're going
to
renegotiate.
It's up to you to keep
mapping them to the user. Yes, that's right. Yep, absolutely. Cool. Oh, okay. I'll take my mic off.